This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and the Sound Outside, the Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Miko Peled took a circuitous route to becoming a Middle East peace activist. He grew up in Israel, the son of Matti Peled, a war hero who fought in the Jewish state's War of Independence in 1948 and who served as a general in 1967 when Israel annexed Gaza, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and Sinai Peninsula. Peled's grandfather was Avraham Nadelson, a Zionist leader and signer of Israel's Declaration of Independence. Miko's current activism can be traced to his father's transformation from a general during the Six-Day War to becoming a scholar in the Arabic language and literature at Tel Aviv University. General Peled later became a passionate peace activist and an advocate of negotiations with the then-outlawed Palestinian Liberation Organization. As a member of the Israeli Knesset or Parliament, he campaigned for an Israeli withdrawal from all the occupied territories he had earlier helped conquer as a general. A family tragedy resulting from political violence in Israel would become a catalyst in Miko's own transformation. A 1997 Palestinian suicide bomb attack in Jerusalem that took the life of his 13-year-old niece, Smadar, became Miko's moment of political awakening. His 2012 book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is a memoir of his family and personal history, recounting his service with the Israeli Special Forces, immigration to the U.S., and his later rejection of Zionism and the advocacy for a one-state solution. Your reporter spoke with Miko Peled, who talks about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from the unique perspective of the son of an Israeli war hero and army veteran turned peace activist.
2 years after my father passed away, he passed away in 1995. 2 years later, in September of 1997, my sister's daughter, who was 13 at the time, was killed in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem. She and several other Israelis. And this, of course, was big news in Israel, as it always is, but it was slightly bigger news because here was the granddaughter of a well-known general, and not only was he a general, but he also made a name for himself as a peace advocate, and so with the Palestinians mainly. And so this was very big news. I was living in the U.S. already at the time. I took the first flight home, and when I got to my sister's apartment in Jerusalem, it was already packed with reporters and people came to express their sorrow. And after the funeral, my sister came out, and she was, of course, asked by the reporters about revenge and retaliation and who she thinks is responsible and so on, or what should be done with the people who are responsible. And she made it very clear. She said, she made a couple of very simple statements that really shook everyone, including me. At first, she said that in terms of retaliation and revenge, she said, look, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. You know, the thought of killing people as a response to the killing of people is absurd. And you know, motherhood being this uniting thing, it unites people beyond any divisions. And that's what she called on. And then she said, in terms of who's responsible, she said, we, you know, the oppression and the brutality of the Israeli occupation against the Palestinians or upon the Palestinians is so great that we've managed to bring these two young men to such a level of hopelessness that they killed themselves, and they took innocent civilians with them. I mean, you can't ignore that, she said. There's no point in blaming them. We have to find out the root cause, and the root cause is the oppression, because she said, when you take away people's land and destroy their homes, and you incarcerate their fathers for, you know, unlimited, you know, years in jail, and then you shoot them and you shoot their brothers and sisters in the schools, which is what Israel does, she said, then this is what happens. So we're paying the price. And she said very clearly that she held the Israeli government responsible for her daughter's death. And of course, this made even bigger waves, because here comes an Israeli bereaved mother and turns everything upside down, because we know that the Palestinians are the aggressors, they're the terrorists, and the Israelis are the victims who always wanted peace. And when I came back here, you know, you can't just go back to life the next day as though nothing happened. When you see that little grave of a 13-year-old child, I mean, you just can't, you know, go about your business like nothing happened. And I was very fortunate that I found a group here in San Diego. It was a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group. And it was the first time I met Palestinians. Now, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. But Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city, is also very segregated. It's a very racist city. So I never met Palestinians until I was here. So it was a very interesting experience for me, and that kind of led me into this exploration and journey, which is, you know, the book is called The General Son, The Journey of an Israeli into Palestine. And that began my journey, which has been going on for a long time now.
Miko, there's a lot of pessimism that peace negotiations will resume anytime soon, and that a long-lasting and just peace will be found anytime soon. What is your recommendation as an Israeli citizen, someone who served in the armed forces? Certainly, you may not have the majority viewpoint of most Israelis, but you do bring something unique to the table in terms of your family history, in terms of your personal loss, and in terms of perspectives maybe you've gained by living outside of Israel for some time. Tell us about your advocacy for a way to break this logjam of this many decades long and very bloody conflict between Israelis and Palestinians.
The reality is that no American president can really make a difference, can make a dent in this issue, because there's such a strong Israeli lobby that has completely controlling, on this particular issue, is controlling American politics and American politicians. No American president can bring about a solution unless they're able to say one of the following things: that Israel must respect human rights and civil rights of the Palestinians, that Israel must release thousands of political prisoners, which Israel called terrorists, but not, most of them have not been charged with acts of violence. Most of them are political prisoners. That Israel allow Palestinians the same amounts of water as it allows Israelis. That Israel stop killing civilians indiscriminately. I mean, until you start having that kind of a conversation, there's not going to be any change, because until Israel stops doing these things, there's not going to be a change. So an American president can't do that, because if he does, the Israeli lobby will shut down Washington, D.C., you know, and there won't be any legislation or anything else going on. That's the reality. The way I see this, Israel has, in fact, created a reality where there is one state over the entire country. We'll call it Israel or call it Palestine, but it's one state, and it's the state of Israel. The West Bank is fully integrated into the state of Israel. So that's not going anywhere. There's never going to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank. Israel has integrated, and everybody knows this. So the question is, do we keep things the way they are? And I think it's a question of values, not so much politics. Keep things the way they are, keep half the population disenfranchised and the state representing only half the population, allowing Israel to keep thousands of political prisoners, allowing Israel to keep discriminating against Palestinians and in aspects of land and water and rights and freedom, and so on, or is there another choice? And the other choice would be to transform this country into a democracy and to allow Palestinians and everybody else who lives there to be equal citizens. The notion of a state of all of its citizens is something that's illegal to propose even in Israel, because it's suggesting it won't be a Jewish state. But the thing is, I don't think you can have a Jewish state and have a democracy when half the population is not Jewish.
That was Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. For more unique perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The battle over coal trains carrying Powder River coal across the Pacific Northwest has been heating up in recent months. Originally, six terminals were proposed in Washington and Oregon, where the coal would be transferred from trains to ships bound for Asia. The plug has been pulled on three of these terminals, but the struggle to stop the coal trains is far from over. This morning, we'll talk about the cumulative effects of shipping millions of tons of coal via train from Montana and Wyoming to ports on the West Coast, just to feed Asia's insatiable appetite for burning coal. My guest is Ryan Alexander with Taxpayers for Common Sense. Ryan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wonder if we could start by talking about why there's such a push to continue mining coal in the Powder River Valley and to ship it to Asia when there's a decreasing demand for coal here in the United States.
Well, I think at the end of the day, coal companies are in the business to mine and sell coal, and they want to make some money. So there's an opportunity to do that the way in the current management system. And so they're thinking, hey, we can do it this way, and they'll make some money out of it. I think it's the responsibility of Congress and the federal government, and particularly the Department of Interior, to kind of be a good manager and steward of our public lands and make sure that we're not giving away the farm, so to speak. I think this is, you know, as we see this problem, it's really a problem of the United States government not doing its fiduciary duty on behalf of taxpayers. If we have an asset, you know, we should ask the question, what are the long-term liabilities? Why? What are we doing here before we develop it? But if we're going to develop it, we got to make sure we get fair market price for that. And the current coal leasing situation is really allowing coal companies to make big profits by exporting the resource.
Well, we'll get to the finances of this in a little bit, but I was just thinking about some remarks I heard by a representative from Peabody Coal about 3 years ago at a conference I went to, where he was arguing that on one hand, he was talking about how Peabody Coal was helping very remote areas of Siberia to develop their